Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Lauren DeYoung-Schulman.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And we have, well, just basically literally everything in the world to cover this week, don't we?
It is an around-the-world version of Bombshell. So fortunately, we come equipped with some very good booze this week.
What are we drinking?
We are drinking, this is from our anniversary show. Ben Wittes brought us a bottle of Prosecco, the Canella Canegliano Valdobbiadene Prosecco.
It's delicious.
It's delightful, whatever it is.
And we're not going to tell Ben that we put ice cubes in it.
Nope.
Excellent. Radha, are you drinking anything?
Oh my God. Guys, I put ice cubes, not ice cream. Different story. Into my wine, too. I'm drinking a delightful rosé from my mom's wine cellar, which wasn't chilled, but I really felt like it was a rosé kind of day. So I put some ice cubes in it, and I'm a class act.
It is not a rosé kind of day here. It's like a hot toddy day here. Yep. I don't know.
It's still winter.
It's never going to end. But that's, I guess, we're all well hydrated for all the things that we have to come on this episode. So excellent. Okay.
April showers.
April showers, indeed. Do we have any announcements?
No announcements. We do have a delightful guest with us today.
Tell us about our guest, please.
Our guest is Amanda Sloat, who is a Robert Bosch Senior Fellow at the Center on United States and Europe at Brookings. She was most recently the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Southern Europe and Eastern Mediterranean Affairs at the State Department, and we are so excited to have her.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
We have a lot of questions for you. Like a lot.
Like a whole lot.
I'm ready. And I have to say, as a longtime listener, one of my first questions was whether you guys are actually drinking. And I am happy to confirm that there is, in fact, fancy Prosecco being consumed as we speak.
In great amounts.
We only have the one bottle, so we'll see how that goes by the time we finish talking about Syria in a few minutes. But before we get to the hard questions, we have the fun questions. Lauren, you want to kick us off?
What is your entrance music?
So I'm a big fan of 1980s hairband music, so it would have to be something
awesome.
Big and bold that I could sing and dance to, and I think I'm going to go with Bon Jovi, It's My Life.
Wow. Oh,
nice.
I could see that.
Yeah.
That'd be great.
I love everything about that answer. It's great.
Do you know who Bon Jovi is, Radha?
I do.
Excellent.
Come on, so I'm proud of you.
We even like Bon Jovi, even though he's from New Jersey.
Okay, Amanda, what is your favorite or most quoted movie line?
So this one is a little bit harder because I honestly never quote movie lines. And in fact, I am the person that pretty much everybody I know at one point or another has said, have you seen X movie, Casablanca, Princess Bride? And I sadly have had to say no. I tend to watch most of my movies on the screen backs of airplanes, and I have a long repertoire of cultural education to catch up on.
Guys, I don't want to break up with you guys, but I just feel like I might have found a little soulmate right here. We can just not know pop culture together. It's going to be great. It's going to be great, guys.
You just have a different set of pop culture references that start with Austen and maybe stop before there were talking pictures.
I mean, talking, but who needs color?
So what book does everyone else love but you can't stand?
I would have to say On the Road by Jack Kerouac. I just can't do stream of consciousness. I don't think I ever even finished it. It was just too rambly.
Are there any women who like that book?
I feel like it's a very dude kind of book.
It's a very dude book.
Radha, are you with me still here?
It's the dude bro book of all times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like the beef jerky of literature.
Yeah. It's the book that men bring up on a date to say I like On the Road. And you're sitting there thinking, oh, God. You probably drink PBR because you think it's cool.
Okay. What is your favorite bar in the world?
So that is an easy one. It is Le Roi d'Espagne in Brussels in the Grand Place. And my favorite thing about the bar is that there is a large actual horse, a stuffed horse inside the bar.
Like a taxidermied horse.
Yes. Yes. Like a taxidermied horse.
Oh, my God. Whoa. It sounds horrific.
It has been there since I'm sure the bar has been there for years and years. It was first there when I was an intern in Brussels in 2000. And so every time I go back to Brussels, I have to pay homage to the taxidermied horse and the overpriced creek and framboise overlooking the Grand Place.
Indeed. All right, Radha, you're up.
What is the best use of data or statistics you have ever seen?
So my current favorite one in thinking about this, I think, has to be Equal Pay Day on April 10th. And the fact that if you think about it, women had to work until April 10th of this year to be equal to what men earned in 2017, and we're already, not that it feels like it outside, but we are a third of the way through the year and moving solidly into spring and towards summer, and women still would have to be working, not to mention how much further that puts them behind this year to catch up with where they would need to be with men by the end of this year.
That is an excellent, excellent answer. We salute you.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's the end of the fun questions.
And now we move on.
What brings us together today is that's a Princess Bride reference.
Yep.
Is
totally knowledge. Missed that one.
See, Rada knows.
I got it. I know something.
So it turns out over the weekend, we launched a significant number of airstrikes against regime targets in Syria. And this time they were not unilateral. We got some allies, the French and the Brits, to join with us. And that has put everyone kind of back in a mode of discussing Syria policy and strategy. Listeners may remember that the last time we talked about this, we basically had no idea what we were talking about. And we're working.
Well, we brought Sarah on.
That's right. We brought Sarah on. And now we brought Amanda on to continue to remedy this. Rada, do you have like a quick summary of kind of where we are today before we dive in with Amanda?
Yeah, so I do. But I should preface this by saying that one, I really just wanted this to be high level. And two, I resisted the urge for it to just be like a basic loud fart sound because it's all so terrible. But roughly, as a sort of framing piece, in 2011, things started going downhill in Syria. There's this guy, Assad, he's in charge. There are a bunch of groups and everything starts getting confusing after that. So my understanding is there are a bunch of Sunni groups, some of which might be jihadists, some of which are just general opposition. There are also some nations that might be providing external support to those Sunni groups, some of which are providing support to jihadists, some of which not so much. There's an excuse on fighting terrorists to combat those groups. Separately, I think stakeholders are Russia, who has a base there and also may or may not be sending mercenaries and or like sort of unmarked troops, and Iran, who has a vested interest in regional dynamics, propping up the Assad regime as wanting to maintain some Shia control. A couple of other issues we might remember are chemical weapons, Obama's famous red line, which there wasn't necessarily a red line for. I believe there was another chemical weapons use after that, but we should talk a little bit more about that. There's also a massive humanitarian crisis. We talked about this before. So basically, we seem to be in a world with a lot of trade-offs, not very effective ceasefires. There were a couple rounds in Geneva that tried to accomplish this. And there have been some movements in the Trump activity, but no clearly announced Syria policy, which in fairness does not deviate from the never announced Syria strategy from the Obama administration.
So basically it's like national security Mad Libs, but all in one country.
Yeah.
Yep.
Also, BBC has a really excellent explainer that we will put in the show notes, but that helped me catch up pretty quickly on who is who in the zoo and where we are in Syria.
Super. Okay. So Amanda, if you could sort of go from there and give us a little bit of a rundown on the civil war dynamics, because one lens for what's going on here and kind of the initial point of departure is a civil war. We have opposition groups to the Assad regime who eventually either morph or themselves become violent in the face of really brutal repression from Assad forces themselves. And so we're now in year six of what, or seven of what looks like, in some ways, just a traditional civil war. Can you talk a little bit about the way that those civil war dynamics and the regime stability dynamics are currently playing out?
Sure. So we have sadly recently passed the 7-year anniversary of the conflict. So we are now moving into year 8 of the fighting. As you recall, when all of this began in 2011, it was school children painting graffiti on walls. It was citizens having peaceful protests and marches in the street calling for democracy, for respect, for dignity. And all of this was happening in the context of the Arab Spring. We'd seen the transitions in Tunisia, Libya, and elsewhere. And it was part of that enthusiasm that I think led Obama and others to declare Assad must go. There was an expectation that Assad was going to be gone within several months. So this started as a civilian uprising, and then, as you said, really began as a civil war with Syrian people taking up arms against the government. So it was in that context text that Obama in particular was not looking to get involved to put the U.S. in the middle of another civil war in the Middle East. But as we have seen, this conflict has continued to grind on. As Rod has said, and as you alluded to, what's happened over the time is you end up having a lot of proxy fighters getting involved in backing various parties and factions within this civil war. So we started with a lot of very moderate Syrian opposition groups. A lot of them were just Syrian civilians who had taken up arms. The problem is, you know, you need money, you need arms, and you need to get it from somewhere. And so what ended up happening is some of these groups ended up getting more arms from various proxy partners within the region that might have had more extremist tensions than others. And so over time, you also ended up seeing some of these moderate Syrian opposition members drifting off to join better funded and better resourced more radical opposition groups.
And this is also in the context, you know, 2011 seems a long ways away now. It's only a few years after Al-Qaeda in Iraq was kind of put to bed, or at least tamped down on the Iraqi side of this conflict. And so we have both a Syrian civil war, but also the reemergence of this specific Al-Qaeda group, and originally an offshoot and then a separate group. There's a separate kind of jihadi fracturing of this space that occurs in the context of this civil war in Syria that's kind of difficult to track.
Right. And then on top of that, you, of course, also had the emergence of the Islamic State. So really, I think you have multiple wars that are now happening in Syria. You have both this civil war that's still going on. And frankly, nobody has really come up with a good solution for how you resolve the peace in Syria. Russia then entered the war at a certain stage, which ended up really bolstering the Assad regime. So what had seemed at a certain point like the Syrian opposition were actually getting momentum to win the civil war, Russia came in and really bolstered a lot of the regime. And so that, on one hand, has made it very difficult to come up with a peace process to try and resolve this. And you now have multiple proxy actors, including Russia, Iran, Turkey, and the U.S. to a certain extent, who all have different desired end games on the ground. And then separately, you've had this war against the Islamic State, which is where the U.S. ended up taking more military action. We are starting to see that conflict wind down, but that still leaves this unresolved question of the broader civil war and continued fighting in Syria.
So in terms of the overall civil war, not just the counter-ISIS fight, in terms of U.S. policy, we are not so much intervening against Assad as we are intervening against ISIS, and only against Assad when it comes to chemical weapons.
That's right.
So that's confusing in and of itself. What's even more confusing is a point that Amanda was bringing up earlier, that is the messaging that we've tried to apply against these chemical weapons attacks. And so can you talk a little about how last year's attack and the U.S. response to it compares to where we are right now, and how the United States is being perceived in the region and amongst other partners, or actually not even partners, partners and adversaries there?
Sure. Let me go back to the one thing you had said first on what the U.S. military role had been. Obama was very clear that he did not want to get involved in the civil war in Syria. And so the U.S. did not take direct military action as part of that because he did not want to go after the regime. The U.S. did have a rather short-lived train and equip program, but it was training and equipping Syrian opposition fighters to fight against the regime. The military was requiring them to take loyalty oaths suggesting they were going to fight against ISIS. They were not going to fight against the regime. If you've been fighting for several years, your brother, your friends have all been killed by the regime, it's going to be a bit of a challenge to switch from that fight to the counter-ISIS fight, which is how the U.S. ended up partnering with a faction of Syrian Kurds, which have caused the Turkey problems, which we can come back to that.
Yes.
But to Lauren's question on the CW, there have been many uses of CW in Syria. The first was in 2013 when Obama was in power. Large-scale use of CW, he of course had said that there was a red line, and Obama decided not to take action. As a constitutional lawyer, there had been a lot of thinking at the time about what the domestic and international legal basis was for this was going to be. The president maintained that he had the authority to do this, but he thought it would be stronger with congressional authorization. Congress did not act to authorize strikes. The French were willing to participate with us, but then we ended up not going forward. The Brits, under Prime Minister Cameron at the time, expressed interest in going along with us. Cameron went to Parliament. There was a vote in Parliament,
right,
and it failed.
Right.
So this trilateral grouping actually was possible in 2013, but for domestic political reasons, both in the U.S. and the U.K., there was not parliamentary congressional authorization to do this. We then saw the chemical attack about a year and a week ago that President Trump decided to respond to. That was only American military action, and he justified that under Article 2 of the Constitution that as Commander-in-Chief, he had the ability to take military action. Fast forward then to a year and where we were last weekend when we again saw the large-scale use of chemical weapons in Syria, which again prompted this debate of whether or not the United States should act. Some people said this was proof that, you know, Obama should have acted in 2013 and enforced this norm. Other people have said the fact that we had repeated usage after we did bomb a year ago shows that if Obama had done anything, maybe it wouldn't have made a difference.
And of course, after the 2013 non-strike, there was this deal with Russia to remove the known stockpiles of various chemical weapons at the time, right? And that's been both lauded and criticized, like obviously you didn't get them all, but also there was 4 years without substantial attack. So
absolutely.
That's, and so that evidence and argument seems to go kind of both ways, but it's definitely part of the complicated landscape, particularly given the Russian involvement in that, enforcing that deal.
Yeah, absolutely. No, and that's a good flag. And arguably there was, as you said, less CW use in that intervening period. One of the things that was noticeable about the strikes that happened this time is the ones a year ago were more targeted at airfields and some aircraft. And this time the strikes were very narrowly targeted at CW manufacturing plants and stockpiles. My sense of the reason for that is that the administration, especially Mattis and the Defense Department, wanted to show that they were not targeting the regime. They were not going after military facilities. They were not going after facilities where the Russians and the Iranians might be based. This was very narrowly targeted on the CW usage. And this time we had the French and the Brits joining us in these strikes. Interestingly, the now Prime Minister in the UK, Theresa May, did not go to Parliament to seek authorization, which is what had caused problems for the Brits a couple of years ago. But we did have a small coalition of forces doing very narrow strikes. And what really, I think, complicated the debate over the last week was the fact that Donald Trump was so forward-leaning on Twitter, making this seem very directed against the Russians, which raises the question of whether or not he was looking at targeting the regime and Russian backing much more broadly, rather than what had been done a year ago and ultimately ended up being done this time, which was very narrow strikes targeting the CW use.
So let's unpack that discussion a little bit, which is, we've talked about a couple of different players in the region, which are Russia and Iran. But talk to me or talk to our listeners a little bit about what the regional dynamics are sort of in the aftermath of a strike like this and sort of what we should be looking for in terms of Iranian and Russian activity sort of going forward. Because obviously, as you said, we have two conflicts going on, right? The regime civil war related conflict and this terrorist conflict that we also care about. And we kind of need them on both sides.
In some ways, this CW strike didn't change anything. And I think President Trump's tweets were really unfortunate because it raised expectations and concerns, neither of which ultimately were met. The reaction, it seems to be from the regime and also from the Russians, is essentially, what, that's all? That's all you're going to do? Which, if that's the reaction, it doesn't necessarily suggest it's going to be a large disincentive to the regime from using strikes again. You know, the French and the others have come out and suggested that if there is continued use, then the U.S. would act again. We had Nikki Haley out very strong this weekend suggesting there was going to be sanctions against the Syrian regime. That has been rolled back by the White House today. So it didn't really change any of the dynamics on the ground in terms of the civil war at all, because the administration was at great pains not to target the regime or anything that might bring into proximity Russian and Iranian forces. So essentially what it did was it satisfied military action, given the expectation that the president had raised with its tweets. And arguably it continued to be international military action to reinforce this international norm that use of chemical weapons is unacceptable.
So one thing that was interesting to me in the reaction to the strikes by the United States, France, and the UK was that, first of all, that Germany stepped up and actually endorsed, which was notable in the sense that they endorsed, did not participate, but they were at least providing some kind of endorsement for their allied action. But that Turkey had a sort of neutral is probably too strong a term. It was more sort of like, meh, we're not really taking sides. But perhaps you can explain a little bit more about Turkey's reaction and how Turkey is perceiving the United States' role, given that the United States is thinking about drawing down its forces there, or actually we don't even really know what it's thinking of doing because it appears to be opposite day in terms of our Syria policy.
Yes, the question of what is U.S. Syria policy is a perplexing and open question. The Turkish reaction is also extremely complicated. At the beginning of the civil war, Erdogan tried to get Assad to engage with his people and have a more peaceful and democratic resolution. Assad was not willing to do that, so then he was essentially dead to Erdogan from that point forward, and Erdogan was wanting to see his overthrow, and so I think willing to turn a blind eye to perhaps some nefarious characters crossing the border. Order to facilitate the overthrow.
Alternately, was totally unhelpful on the counter-ISIS campaign from a border perspective, given the Syria-Turkish border, right? I mean, there was definitely a lot that the U.S. wanted him to do.
Lax border controls, yes. So I spent much of my time in government working with colleagues to try and
persuade. I never worked at the State Department, so I can say definitely part of the problem and not part of the solution.
But then they came around and became part of the solution. They ended up closing off their border. They opened Incirlik Air Base to U.S. and coalition partners flying out of there. The problem is that then Turkey and U.S. relations began to sour because the U.S. was working with this faction of Syrian Kurdish forces, the YPG, on the ground in Syria. As I mentioned earlier, the U.S. was finding it difficult to find ground forces to partner with because they wanted ones that were willing to fight ISIS and not the regime, and most of the opposition wanted to fight the regime. The YPG were willing to fight against the Islamic State. The problem is that the YPG are affiliated with the PKK, which is a designated terrorist organization in Turkey that has killed tens of thousands of Turks in the last number of decades. So that created a lot of tension between the two countries, and Erdogan's number one policy goal shifted from preventing the Syrian Kurds from achieving this desire to create an autonomous region in northern Syria. In order to do that, Turkey at various stages has taken military action to try and block the Syrian Kurds from creating the space. So that's where Russia ends up coming into play. Turkey and Russia have had very complicated relations. You'll remember a couple of years ago, Turkey shot down a Russian jet that violated its airspace on the border, led to lots of sanctions, and then Erdogan ultimately had to apologize to Putin to try and get relations back on track because he wanted to launch Operation Euphrates Shield to block these Syrian Kurdish forces from connecting a number of cantons on the border into a single autonomous region. So that led to a bit of rapprochement with Russia. It led to this military operation there. Then later, you ended up having Turkey working with Russia and Iran to try and do some deconfliction zones, some ceasefires, and then ultimately a political process, which, to get back to Lauren's initial question, ends up creating a very complicated dynamic between Turkey and Russia on the ground. Ultimately, I think Erdogan would still like to see Assad gone. From Russia's perspective, they don't want to see Assad pushed out. And yet, Turkey has had interests in continuing to work with Russia to achieve their goal on the ground of limiting the creation of the Syrian Kurdish region. This also gives them conflicted feelings about what the U.S. military posture is. Mm-hmm. On one hand, they don't want the U.S. to stay there indefinitely. And we're very concerned at the beginning of the year about this idea of the creation of a 30,000 strong border security force because they don't want the U.S. to be providing security guarantees for this Kurdish region. On the other hand, if the U.S. pulls out quickly, that opens up the possibility of Iranian and other actors dominating the space on their border.
But it does suggest that perhaps Turkey and Russia have a sort of shared interest in the territorial integrity of Syria in a formal sense, even if they have a little bit of disagreement over to who has the official political control of that. Namely, they don't have any interest in some sort of Kurdish regional government, KRG style approach, which is what has basically happened. It's not a de facto partition, but it's a de facto partition in Iraq. Turkey definitely doesn't want to see that in Syria, nor do the Russians. And so they have at least some minimal alignment on the regime is the regime, the borders are the borders, and we're not going to allow some like crazy devolution scheme internally, which of course would be the basis of which some sort of Geneva style peace process would probably go down. So that strikes us that that's part of the complication there. I don't want to curtail that, but I do want to talk about NSC process.
So I keep coming back to the fact that all of this was going on during John Bolton's first week in the job.
Hi.
Which, yeah, you know, welcome. Here's your desk. Here's your email password. And also, what do you think about strikes on Syria? So you've been part of the office that would have thought about what are the options in terms of how to respond to what's going on in Syria right now. John Bolton shows up. It's his first week in the office. What can we tell about how well his NSC is going to function, how he is going to be slightly different than McMaster on this? Or can we tell anything at all, given that this is the response that happened? It's probably not what John Bolton himself would necessarily have wanted to have happen in response to Syria.
I think it's too soon to draw conclusions from this specific case about how Bolton is going to operate. My sense is that where we ended up had Mattis's fingerprints all over it in terms of trying to get back to a much more deliberative policy process within the NSC to take time to bring our our coalition partners along, to join the coalition, to identify strike targets that were not going to conflict with where the Russians and Iranians were, that were not going to set up potential retaliation against the 2,000 American forces that we have on the ground. So to me, where we ended up is much more telling about the continued influence of Defense Secretary Mattis than necessarily giving any early indications of where Bolton is on this.
Of course, we also don't have a Secretary of State. So
I keep forgetting that.
It's a little bit of a...
It's a little
awkward.
I'm very interested in how Pompeo plays in this mix. Mm-hmm. And if Mattis is able to maintain his influence in that dynamic, especially if Bolton and Pompeo get on the same side of an issue.
I think that's absolutely right. And it comes back to this question of what is our Syria policy ultimately? What is it we are trying to accomplish? You'll remember that we've had Trump saying that he wants to get out of Syria. He has said that we are going to...
Last week. Within 48 hours, which, by the way, is not actually possible.
He has told Erdogan that we are going to stop arming the YPG in this fight on the ground, which caused the military to come out and say, well, we're looking at this. We had Secretary Tillerson give this Stanford speech in January, really changing the scope of the mission from countering ISIS to suddenly also countering Iran, going after WMD, allowing refugees to return home. And then we've had General Votel saying that the military's only mission is to counter ISIS, and yet making very clear that they want to continue working with these Kurdish partners on the ground.
And also making pleas for reconstruction. I mean, that was that USIP event 10 days ago, basically, right? It's not even 2 weeks ago that, you know, on one day we have at one end of the district down by the river, you have Votel and Brett McGurk making a fairly traditional foreign policy establishment, full-throated, long-term campaign, and the president is in a press conference saying, we're out of there, you know, less than a mile away. I mean, it's just, that's the level of policy incoherence that we're trying to deal with, and meanwhile, we're going to launch multilateral large-scale airstrikes in the mix of it.
So one question I have about the Bolton regime is whether or not he is going to personally allow this amount of incoherence amongst the public spokesman for the administration, where it didn't really seem like McMaster had that much control or necessarily cared that Haley and Mattis and Tillerson and the president were all saying very different things. Some amount of that is uncontrollable, but it's very clearly, we've never actually told Nikki Haley, no, you can't have that sort of policy agenda up in the UN because it completely diverges with where the president is.
You do get the feeling that having been the ambassador to the UN and being a much more savvy bureaucratic player, that John Bolton's tolerance for that's going to be rather limited.
Although you say that in just in the last 6 hours, I guess, we have had this happen with Nikki Haley coming out very strongly at the Security Council saying the U.S. was going to be sanctioning, and the White House now rolling that back.
Well, she didn't check with anyone, apparently.
That is what the NSC staff have been messaging, although I think she notoriously has been going straight to the big boss to get things checked. And she's usually quite cautious. I mean, she's not always so forward-leaning. She seems to at least check with the president, even if she's not, you know, getting interagency clear talking points for what she says.
Well, I think we've covered a lot of ground and still hardly any of the ground. And so I'm almost certain that we'll be back to this topic sometime soon. But we do want to thank Amanda for joining us and providing a great deal of clarity to some very, very complicated issues. So thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Shall we move on to keeping up foreign relations? Perhaps a lightning round?
Yeah.
Radha, would you like to kick us off?
We have so much to cover.
We do.
Let's start with trade war, shall we?
Are we in a trade war? I'm confused.
Ish. So here, to catch us all up, China and the U.S. are going a little tit for tat on tariffs. So they have put tariffs on porks, nuts, and fruits, which is not great for us. And their next round, in response to, I believe, Section 301, which are tariffs we're planning to lay on them, is a tariff on soybeans. And that would be very, very, very bad for U.S. agriculture. Turns out it's extra very bad because of the TPP, which folks might remember was an agreement that was negotiated under the Obama administration and signed, but not really in effect, that Trump repealed basically when he came into office with a bunch of East Asian countries that was intended to sort of curtail Chinese influence in the region. But also the people who stayed in it were Canada and Mexico. So now we're in a situation where their agricultural exports get to go there and ours don't, which is sad for our farmers. On the pros for TPP is, you know, I don't know, steel. It's not totally clear what the pros are. Nobody who's an economist really likes the fact that we're anti-free trade anymore. But there was...
I mean, the pros for leaving TPP were unclear.
Correct.
Right.
The pros for leaving TPP were quite unclear. But the cons for leaving it are that, you know, now we don't have that agreement with those countries. Also, countries that we really like Japan and South Korea, are in a really awkward position when we say things like we want to rejoin, which the Trump administration did last week. So we're currently in a state of play where Australia, Japan and South Korea have sort of coolly accepted that the U.S. might want to renegotiate. It's not clear what those terms might be. But sort of bigger picture, we want to worry about our interactions with Japan and South Korea, because we want to engage with them on things like North Korea. We don't want to totally piss off China and go on a trade war with them, because we also need them for things like North Korea. But at the same time, sort of the Trump base really wants proactive anti-Chinese in particular issues, and wants potentially renegotiated terms on the TPP. Those terms would largely focus on sort of the what counts as sole source in an effort to sort of bolster the amount of stuff that's produced in the U.S. So we'll live and learn here. You know, we'll try not to start an actual war with China. We probably maybe will get potentially exactly the same terms from TPP that we had before, and the Trump administration could call that a win.
Are any of the actual Chinese tariffs been imposed yet on our side or the other side?
I think that they have both been announced, and the underlying processes for implementation haven't occurred, but will in the next few months. So they are sort of in train. The pork, nuts, fruits tariff is the one that's in train. The Section 301, the right. tariff on Chinese goods, and the response ag soybean tariff are not yet implemented. They're more like saber rattling.
So do you think that China's choice of pork, nuts, and fruits has anything to do with their understanding of American slang, or was it more kind of focused on actual goods?
And or domestic political considerations of the Trump political base?
I think they wanted to hit us where it hurts, and you can interpret that as you will.
You're Radha, so funny.
Radha, I will be the thunder to your lightning. And I will talk about what's going on in Israeli-Palestinian issues as quickly as I can. So you all may have noticed that there is a bit of drama going on, particularly on the border of the Gaza Strip and Israel right now, in terms of violence and protests are going on there. So what's going on? You may recall during the campaign, President Trump, then candidate Trump, pledged to move the U.S. embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. He eventually has actually made good on this promise, or is on his way to doing so, where he made a firm announcement to do so earlier this year. This isn't actually as complicated a deal as you might think. It's basically just redesignating a consulate that already existed in West Jerusalem as the American embassy there. That is set to take place in mid-May, around the time period of the 70th anniversary celebrations of Israeli independence. But at the same time, this is basically a giant FU to the Palestinians, who also celebrate around that day something called Nakba, day, the National Day of Palestinian Mourning, marking the catastrophe of Israel's founding, commemorated every year on May 15th.
The catastrophe of Palestinian expulsion, depending on who you ask.
So I think Catastrophe Day could be possibly be my favorite new holiday name of all time. So when this was announced, the Palestinians, or many Palestinians, declared that there would be weekly protests every Friday, particularly in Gaza, leading up to the actual moving of the embassy to Jerusalem. This was resulted in nearly a thousand or thousands of people rather being injured, and I think somewhere around estimated 20 or so Palestinians actually being killed. The Israelis would say that the protests going on are camouflage for Hamas infiltrators trying to launch attacks. Other Palestinians would say these are peaceful protests, that the Israeli soldiers are targeting people like the press, peaceful protesters, children, folks who are having nothing to do with violence against Israel. And the U.S. has not at this time played any kind of moderating influence. Typically around this time, the United States would make some kind of policy statement to say, hey guys, chill out. Let's, Israel, please back off a little bit. Palestinians, please, lower the temperature on your protests. This has not been the case, in particular, as they have moved forward with their embassy move. However, because process is not the United States' Valentine, they need to build a wall around the new embassy. And thus the move will not actually take place when they're saying it will. So it's all kind of awkward now.
Okay. I have neither thunder nor lightning, but a small reminder of an issue that seems like 1,000 years ago, which occurred just after we recorded the last episode, which was that we exchanged expulsions with the Russian government of various embassy officials.
Oh. Yeah.
Remember when we did that a lifetime ago, except that it was just like 12 days. And so the United States, in response to the nerve agent attack in England, has expelled 60 Russian embassy officials who we had designated primarily as intelligence officers. And the Russians both responded in kind, and there was an effort or an expectation that there actually might be some further escalation there. What's interesting, and this is a little bit back in the news, is there was a very interesting Washington Post report today, and we're recording on Monday, about how the National Security Council has been rolling the president on Russia policy for a matter of months now. And this was sort of the latest episode in a set of expectations where he was surprised that what the policy outcome actually was. So what we will see, this drama seems to have mostly... Well, it seems like it's drawn down probably because it's been drowned out by the Syria attacks themselves. But I'm told by folks who are spending time in London that it's still very much a domestic political issue in England. And we'll keep watching kind of how that dynamic plays out. But there's been definitely on several fronts increasing diplomatic tension between the United States and Russia, with the president sitting in a very awkward position there as well. Lightning round. We're done.
Good work, team.
White House mayhem.
Here we come.
Okay, so we want to do something a little bit different on White House mayhem. We've talked about John Bolton's first week, and we'll probably come back to his role here pretty soon. But there's been a couple of defense policy or readiness kinds of issues that we wanted to flag here. And the first of which are both a series of aviation mishaps. We referenced those a couple of weeks ago. There was a F-18 crash. There were multiple Marine helicopter crashes. There was, I think, a third. There was a Harrier crash as well. And this comes in sort of a broader context of aviation challenges and readiness issues. And it turns out that Tara Kopp at Military Times had gone back and put together a very interesting data set of military aviation mishaps. And I guess the TLDR version is, it's not just you, it is getting worse. Is that the right conclusion there?
Yeah. According to the analysis that Tara did, accidents involving all kinds of military aircraft have risen by about 40% from 2013 to 2017. It's actually doubled for some aircraft, like the F-18 Hornets and Super Hornets. 133 service members were killed in those years. And while we tend to hear more about the accidents that result in some kind of injury or death, there's actually been a substantial, like a far larger substantial increase in what you would call Class C mishaps, which are a lot smaller, are not necessarily causing minor injuries or minor impact to airframes. But that's kind of that's the indicator that we should be watching, is to see, you know, how bad is it on the high end, but also on the low end of these mishaps going forward.
And there's a lot of speculation. Well, there's speculation, and I think there's some increasing research that the sequester years hurt this, because the easiest budgets to trim are training budgets because they're fungible year to year. And so you had a period of time where there were fewer flight hours. You also had a period of time where there were fewer spare parts procured. And so now you're in a kind of double whammy situation where some pilots don't have as many hours in the air as maybe they would have had otherwise. But also that there just aren't enough spare parts to keep all the planes and airframes, and by plane, I mean both rotary and fixed wing, in the air sufficient to get everybody up to speed on hours. It's actually a quite complex system in terms of generating that aviation readiness. And I don't think we have a super simple answer. I certainly would not want to come to the conclusion that it was purely the fault of the sequester year. There's more to it than that. But again, kind of comes back to the challenges of budgetary uncertainty and the way that these things have kind of long tails, you know, into the services, all of which have various aviation assets. So it's difficult to watch. You know, if you have friends in these communities, they all know not just someone, but multiple someones who have died in aviation mishaps in the last few years, especially on the Nav Air side. And Marines and Navy pilots have just really been hit very hard by this. And it'll be interesting to see how that plays into budget discussions and the broader readiness discussion. You know, we talked about the Seventh Fleet mishaps earlier this year as well, obviously.
And it's also a good reminder of the sort of tactical and human implications of our strategic decisions on sort of outward projection. So as we need to keep having high op tempo and lots of activities happening, we're going to need to keep having these training missions. And so, you know, there is a human life to those training missions, not just to the combat missions, and it's worth remembering that.
I think one thing to watch on this is that Mattis, as well as the Joint Staff, have resisted really talking about this trend in public. Both Mattis is resistant because he thinks that, you know, gives the enemy information that they shouldn't necessarily have, and the Joint Staff, and because they don't necessarily want to cite a trend where they are still investigating some of these individual mishaps as individual mishaps. They're looking at what was the actual cause here. Congress obviously is probably going to have none of that and want to have a lot more detail as they hear from the services as well as others in the coming months in terms of budget discussions. But the resistance from DOD to actually talk about this problem in public in a really comprehensive way is, I think, possibly going to have morale impacts and something that we should sort of watch in terms of how interested they are in solving this challenge.
Phil Clay, of course, had an excellent piece in The Atlantic on the broader morale issues going on kind of in a services that are participating in a war on terror or a set of forever wars. And this is a little bit different focus. Most of those pieces tend to focus on the ground forces, but there's certainly some morale issues on the aviation side that are worth addressing. On the flip side, a bit of, I think, good news, or at least an anniversary to mark with regard to combat integration.
Yeah. So this week, this coming Friday, is the 3-year anniversary of 19 women across the Army starting at Ranger School, in that first group, about three of whom actually ended up graduating several months later in August and October. And several months later, you saw Secretary Carter, at the end of 2015, actually announcing a policy of how having women being integrated into all combat roles across DOD, despite resistance from some services, in particular the Marine Corps. And I think you've seen varying levels of progress from each of the services. Probably, I mean, obviously the Navy and the Air Force were a little bit ahead of their peers. The Army has done a bit better in terms of both recruitment and also progression through different training systems. The Marine Corps, frankly, is way, way behind, I think, for reasons that are probably obvious to a lot of listeners to this podcast. And it will be interesting to see how much emphasis Mattis and the service secretaries really put on this going forward to make sure that combat integration is receiving the leadership attention that it needs.
I will say combat integration also paved the way to have sort of these gender neutral standards. So standards that were related to how the work that was required from the unit rather than the gender of the person doing it, which was really the underpinning of some of the transgender discussion and the minimal sort of impact on that as we think about broader integration efforts. So it'll be interesting to see how this goes forward, how these sort of gender neutral standards play out, how the performance of these folks play out, and also sort of how that ends up being handled within the context of the ongoing dispute on the transgender ban, which was just blocked by a U.S. district court.
And of course, Kate Germano, who's a retired Marine officer and had been at the training school at Paris Island, her new book is out detailing her very fraught struggle to actually level the playing field in many ways for female recruits in the Marine Corps. But it's a complicated story, but it provides some of that insight on the unique Marine features who definitely have had a different experience with women in the service than certainly the Army or the Navy. To know folks, to have friends who are in all these services, they actually all have quite different lived experiences, both at the officer and the enlisted level. And I think, you know, one of the best things people can do is to just listen to those stories and hear some of the differences and hear both the challenges and the opportunities that everybody has experienced, the women in particular, because it's not a one-sided or one unidirectional story, but it's a complicated one. And I see the pictures from Ranger School, that initial group of female graduates, and it's still just one of the most extraordinary things. So, before we get to pop culture, we have one more White House mayhem topic, which was, again, these are things that seem like they happened, you know, in the before time. but maybe we're going to send regular Army units or at least National Guard units to the border with Mexico. And these basically are things that, like, again, policy by tweet, the president declares something, and then the poor people of the Defense Department are required to, like, defend, not even defend, but to be like, we're working on that. We'll take a
look. I'm waiting for the, like, Dilbert comic equivalent of the Defense Department during the Trump administration, where it's like a bunch of sort of like 05s and 06s who are like, I used to carry a gun and walk on the battlefield. Now I watch Twitter. Just waiting. It's coming, guys.
But, you know, friend of the show, Lindsey Cohn, had a really great tweet storm sort of explaining why, you know, your reliance on posse comitatus for as the last line of defense of American democracy is both ahistorical and poorly informed, and why this is actually the kind of thing that regular Army troops and especially National Guard troops have done repeatedly in the history of the American Republic. And so I don't think that we know exactly what those plans are going to look like. You know, President Obama and President Bush sent National Guard troops to the border at different times. And this is the U.S.-Mexico border, of course. And, you know, so on one hand, this is kind of a continuation or a repeat of a previously implemented policy, but it just has a lot of different connotations, both with regard to immigration policy, but also with regard to kind of domestic use of force or the idea of, like, what the civil military balance is. And so it feels a little different.
I had so many questions, like, under what authority are you planning to use them? What are their responsibilities going to be? Who's bearing the financial cost of this? Like, just how does it count for things like general accrued time and benefits?
Oh, my God, you're such a nerd.
Basically, the choice was Army modernization or sends soldiers to the border. And they chose to send them to the border because the video game industry is really hurting these days. And they wanted them to be able to have something to do while they're down there.
My, like, actually a favorite part of this was when the governor of California issued the statement that whatever it is that they want these guys to do, we find it unsupportable, where you're like, you don't even want to wait to see what the request is to say. It's just the whole thing is.
Well, the irony
mess.
Is that usually it's the governors who make the request. And so that's the challenge right here, especially if you're going to talk about deployment of National Guard troops. So I guess we'll see what that exactly looks like in the next few weeks and months. Have either of you consumed any pop culture lately?
In my household, we were watching Lord of the Rings again for the 90th time, which I got to say, those are really long. Like,
yeah.
how did I sit through a theater for that period of time? I have no idea. But it has given me a new reason to walk around to people and say, I'm glad you're here with me, Sam, here at the end of all things.
The Return of the King is a movie that literally will not end.
No, it has 70 endings, and it doesn't even include most of those in the book.
Right. It's terrible. It's not my favorite.
I watched many movies on the plane, so I'm like sort of caught up in from pop culture like from 5 months ago. But I would like to recommend the show Pieces of Life, which is like a mix between Modern Family and Parenthood. So I feel like we could all get on board with this together.
Oh, I have not seen that.
You want to talk about Killing Eve, don't you?
I
can tell.
Killing Eve has Sandra Oh from Grey's Anatomy.
I'm in love.
As like, you know, kind of bloodthirsty, not bloodthirsty, but just, you know, doesn't quite have all the usual social sensibilities, but she works for a British law enforcement agency and ends up tracking a totally psychopathic female assassin. And so it's both very interesting. If you like British mysteries, it's pretty good. If you like kind of...
What if you like Jane Austen? Is it good for that?
I don't know that it has a lot of Jane Austen overtones.
However, the assassin is played by the woman who plays the White Princess on that Showtime series.
Yeah.
Which, like, I've never watched, but I've watched the Twitter ad for it over and over and over again.
I also saw The Death of Stalin, which is like Clue plus your Twitter feed somehow. I mean, it's like, it's total farce. It's hilarious. Oh.
Well, that's fun.
Zhukov is played by Malfoy's dad, Jason Isaacs, and he's awesome. By far, like, steals the show. But it's actually really, really fabulous satire of 1950s Russia and therefore totally relevant today.
I have one last piece of amazing pop culture. Okay, so in my teen years, I read maybe a small amount of Star Wars fan fiction, maybe a large.
Maybe.
And I thought I was basically the only person on the planet who read fan fiction. However, Nicole Cliff tweeted the other day, what is your favorite fan fiction of all time? And there's like this maybe 70 million tweet thread of all these people responding with like Harry Potter, mostly Harry Potter, but a lot of other things.
X-Files.
Too.
I bet X-Files. There was a lot of X-Files.
A whole lot of X-Files, Star Wars, Star Trek, Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Yep.
The amount of fan fiction, like Ben Wickler from Move On responded with one of his favorites. I mean.
Did you find your people, Lauren?
I found my people. I'm so happy.
Those are not my people.
My favorite was Stuff. Just saying.
Waiting for the Cheetah fan club tweet. Any day, Nicole.
Let me tell you how you don't want the Cheetah fan fiction, Radha.
You've made me blush.
On that note, I think we're done here. Anything else, ladies?
No, till next time.
Bye-bye.